Your first eight guys maybe should be blue plate specials, but those back five guys, they should be more like tin hats, more guys that are grunt players, garbage players that dive for the ball.
You are listening to the Scrambled Eggs Podcast on CrackedSidewalks.com.
So, being optimistic, that lasted a week. Welcome into Scrambled Eggs, everyone, your unofficial Marquette basketball podcast. Joe McCann and Phil Bush here with you. Phil, we're going to jump right into it. Why was that so terrible?
For the second week in a row, I'm starting the podcast by opening a beer. that was pretty terrible. It was terrible because, quite frankly, that was the worst coach game by Wojo I have ever seen.
Yeah, and so today's pod, we're going to jump into basically just the crushing loss at DePaul and see if there is any hope moving forward for this season. We'll debate that a little later. Time permitting, we may get into some of the FBI stuff hanging over college basketball.
The confirmed bag dropping?
Yeah, we will maybe get into it from a Marquette perspective, just because I know everyone else has been breaking it down from a national perspective. That's going to be time permitting because we're trying to get this podcast in while Owen is napping. So if you hear somebody screaming in the background, it may be me, but it also may be Owen, and we have to wrap this podcast up soon. Can't record it on Sunday, so we're kind of doing a quick, rapid reaction right after the DePaul game on Saturday.
We're keeping the pain fresh. It'll be oozing out of the podcast.
Yeah, so hopefully you guys can consume this on Sunday or maybe even Saturday evening. We'll see how it goes. But Phil, watching the game on Saturday, it was kind of a worst-case scenario for Marquette with the season on the line, going to DePaul, a game you really, really need to win to avoid a terrible loss on your resume. And just so many things went wrong in that game, especially in the second half. I'll start with one thing many people are pointing out, people I'm following on Twitter, is that you can blame it on this maybe a little, there are other things at stake, but the fact is Marquette went back to playing Howard and Rousey together from almost the entire second half, and everything just kind of went to hell.
Yeah, it was kind of mind-boggling. And like I said, I referenced at the top that it was the worst coaching job by Wojo I've seen yet. And that's quite frankly, I mean, not only did he play Rousey and Howard together, and Rousey was playing terrible, like terrible. And, you know, so what probably shouldn't have been on the floor anyway, aside from the lesson that Wojo apparently hasn't learned, which is don't play them together. But it was other curious coaching decisions, like Theo John did not play but 3 or 4 minutes in the second half when we were having trouble rebounding. Froling was nailed to the bench, did not play, coach's decision.
Second straight game, by the way, ever since logging a 6 trillion against Creighton, 6 minutes played, zero other stats accumulated. He has not played a second since then. So I'm not sure what's going on there, but yes, continue.
Yeah. So they built a lead going into halftime with a lineup that was some semblance of Marcus or, you know, either Rousey or Marcus, Greg, occasional Kane, and it was, you know, Helter, Theo with Sam, and Sam played all 40 minutes. It was inexplicable that lineup did not reappear in the second half, even midway through the half when it was still contestable at that point.
Yeah, I mean, the most glaring thing statistically, if you want to step away from playing the two little guards together, is they just gave up so many offensive rebounds in that game. DePaul got a lot of second chances, and you kind of alluded to it there. It may have been nice to see Froling, who, for many of his flaws, is a very good rebounder, or a little more Theo John in the second half. But also, when you have two guys below 6 feet out there, that maybe also hurts you size-wise as well. So I think certainly that was a glaring thing, but you touched on it there, Phil. You know, Rousey just had one of those games where he was shooting a lot, and the shots weren't falling. He wasn't distributing. You know, Wojo said after the St. John's game, after which I praised Wojo, many of us did, he did a great job in that game, Wojo and Rousey. When Rousey, I think he had 8 assists, and he only had like 1 turnover or something that game.
Yeah.
Only had 1 assist in the DePaul game, and was like 3 of 11 from 3. So
it's tough
to survive
a bad game
like that from Rousey. And then when you're not rebounding, it just compounds everything.
Yeah, well, and I think it's, you know, people can say, well, why didn't they play more 2-3 or whatever? I think my biggest issue was not – I mean, sometimes the offense is just going to be off, right? I mean, I don't think DePaul did anything that was remarkably – other than the rebounding – that remarkably impacted Marquette. Yes, they had a little more length on the shooters, which is, again, why you don't put two sub-6-feet players out there. It makes guarding them easier with long players. Having said that, Marquette had plenty of open looks that they just didn't hit. And you know what? That's going to happen from time to time. That's just the nature of the offense. You're going to have games where your shot's not falling. So I don't have a problem with what happened with the offense. I don't even really have a problem with the defensive strategy because DePaul's just not good offensively. And we held them to, you know, 70 points, if you will. And a fair number of those were foul shots we were trying to get back into the game. It was just the player personnel. Like, I don't understand the lineups. I don't understand the substitution patterns. And like you mentioned, Joe, we were singing the praises of Wojo after the St. John's game and you know, the Creighton game, the second half. Like, it's almost like Wojo went, yeah, I know I could be good, but let's see how bad I can be.
Yeah. Wojo is going to make the tournament with Howard and Rousey together or go to the NIT trying. That is kind of his mindset. He is convinced that is Marquette's way forward. And it's short of Coach K and Brad Stevens and Greg Popovich all calling and saying, you know, Steve, I'm not sure those two guys playing together works. I don't think anyone's going to convince him otherwise. I don't think anyone is going to convince him that splitting those guys up is Marquette's best way forward. He's going to play them together. And come hell or high water, Marquette's just going to live with the results. Like, I think he was convinced that entire second half that even though the offense was struggling, that having both those guys out there with Sam Hauser, the offense was eventually going to get going. And logically, you would think that would make sense, but it hasn't worked mostly all season.
Well, but it was crazy.
And I think at some point you have to just admit, like, I might be wrong about this.
Yes. So this is some sort of stubborn thing, right? At this point, there is no intellectual reason why you play those two guys together and why you play those two guys together with Marcus playing 31 minutes on a bum hip problem, you know, some sort of contusion. I mean, he's a tough guy, but still.
Yeah, I will say this, that was kind of forced in the first half because Rousey got two quick fouls, so he went right to the bench, and Howard probably came in 5 minutes of game time sooner than Wojo had planned. And then I think, in a way, that was the worst thing that happened. Rousey going out early and Howard playing most of the first half, and Wojo say, you know what, Marcus is good. I'm going to go back and we can play him together. He can play the whole game. Yeah. And I think that really kind of started things going awry. I think maybe coming into the game, the plan was to play Marcus sparingly and let Rousey lead the charge. And maybe the game would have gone much differently had they stuck to that plan. But I think Wojo kind of called an audible there when he saw Howard was able to play, even though he wasn't necessarily shooting the ball particularly well in the first half, or scoring well in the first half, and he stuck with, you know, rolling with them together throughout the second half, and that's when things just kind of spiraled out of control.
Yeah, and again, I'm struggling. It's kind of fresh, and admittedly, you saved me because this is the second crappy road team we've played that I haven't been able to watch live, so I should probably take some blame for this. But you did text me and said, zoom through, don't even bother watching it wire to wire because it was craptacular.
Yes, yeah, so I didn't want you to literally sit through 2 hours thinking, because you would even warn me, say, look, if it goes poorly, just tell me. And I'm like, I'm not going to make Phil sit through 2.5 hours of this thinking they may have come back and won. I'm just going to spare him. So I said, hey, don't watch. We lost. It was awful. And it kind of was.
It was
a real bummer.
Yeah, it did. Well, I do have to thank you because you did the opposite of my buddy Weggs, who I had to the Xavier game at Xavier where we got blown out, ran into him at a concert we were at, and he's like, did you set your DVR to record extra? And he's like, yeah. And I was like, yeah. He's like, okay, that's all I'm going to say. And I'm like, oh, they must have gone to overtime. Turns out it took 20 minutes of repairing a net for us to get blown out. So I appreciate the support for my psyche. But, you know, having watched the game like real recently and like I said, at a bit of a speed, so I didn't see every single play, I don't think on the offensive end there were any problems there. The defensive end, I don't think the defense was any worse than it was before. It was I just think it was coaches doing the wrong things, putting players in a position where they couldn't win.
Yeah, they did miss a lot of wide open shots. That, you know, if a few of those wide open threes in the second half fall, maybe it's a different story.
Well, even in the first half, they had a number of Jamal Cain had a couple of corner threes. Sakar had a corner three, and a floater. Sakar did not play well either. It was like basically everyone said, DePaul, they kind of suck. Let's just get out of there with a win and go home, and decided not to get that even.
Yeah.
I mean, it sucks.
Like I said,
go ahead.
No, I was saying, you know, watching in the second half, I noticed Howard and Rousey out there together, like we all did. And I was trying to watch, thinking, all right, is this going to be the reason they lose? And I wouldn't say, like, that was the main reason things went to hell. Like, but I mean, there were certainly some opportunities where DePaul, because, you know, when you got two little guards out there and Marquette's playing man to man, there's a lot of pick and roll opportunities, and DePaul did. You know, run some pick and roll against those guys, particularly Rousey. But to me, more so than playing those two guards together was just the lack of rebounding and the second chance points for DePaul that really kind of made a difference in the half. So while I still think playing Howard and Rousey together is a bad idea, I think the rebounding was more of an issue in the game on Saturday.
Yeah, no, absolutely. The rebounding was the reason they lost. And you could and this team has been a solid rebounding team. So that's really an effort thing, and I guess you gotta hold the players accountable, right, to a certain extent for their own effort. But again, I circle back and say this is kind of on the coaching staff, which is just mind-boggling because it's weird, we don't record these podcasts any sooner than once a week, or any more frequently than once a week, and that's good for everyone's sake. But, I mean, if you look back to the St. John's game, which happened, it feels like an eternity ago, but was Wednesday, I mean, I was on Twitter praising the tremendous coaching that Wojo had in that game in terms of the way he managed the minutes, the way he did the strategies, the way he managed the 2-3 zone. And then this was like the exact opposite of that. So, I'm struggling understanding what was different.
If you want to be super pessimist, and there may be some truth to this, but you could say what happened against St. John's was mostly forced by not having Marcus Howard.
Right.
Yeah, he doesn't do like the strategic thing when he has the options available to do the he only like, you know, goes to the zone and only plays one small guard when he has no other option. So again, maybe that's a pessimistic way of looking at it, but also perhaps a truthful way of looking at it.
No, I actually think that's right. And there is zero credence to that. I saw a little bit of flavor on the internet that seemed to be like, oh, maybe we're better without Marcus Howard playing. That is undoubtedly false. Now, how we use Marcus Howard, what's that?
Yeah, that's crazy for sure.
Right. Now, how we use Marcus Howard is another thing entirely, right? I mean, Marcus Howard, I think, honestly, and I have no way of proving this, but if Rousey's pelvis exploded at Creighton instead of Marcus's, I think maybe the results are similar because, you know, I think Marcus is probably a better shooter and not as good at distributing. So, but I mean, this is a non-scientific thought experiment, but I think the results would be similar because, again, it forced Wojo to do the right thing, which is play one of the two at all times and play them together as minimally as possible. So that's the thing. So we talked about it a lot, but I don't understand. I agree with the pessimistic view that Wojo is just refusing to see what I think is the obvious, that he has to split those two up as much as possible.
I hope it's not because he's afraid of hurting somebody's feelings about losing
God.
His starting
get
spot.
Get out of the coaching box.
Right. You know, it's like, sit him down and say, look, guys, everything we've looked at says you guys are better when you're apart. So we're going to split you guys up and maybe each play 25 minutes a game. Maybe there'll be a couple stretches when you're together, but mostly we're going to divide up the point guard duties and we're going to get some more minutes to the better defenders. And I think it gives us a better chance to win as a team. Let's try this And I would hope both of those guys would be on board, because I think that's what's in the best interest of the team if you're hoping to win some games down the stretch and still cling to whatever small hope you may have of making the tournament. But, yeah, like I said, it may just be a thing. He loves the possibility of the offense with Rousey, Howard, and Hauser all out there together. But, you know, here we are. It's almost March, and I think there's enough statistical data out there to prove that, yeah, while the offense may be better, the defense is so much worse, and the team is just a little bit worse overall when they're together. It's maybe time to open up to the idea that your two best scorers are better apart.
Yeah, and do you chalk this up to Wojo's a bad coach? He's a stubborn coach. Some combination there. I mean, like, even the assistants have to be, at this point, have to be going, coach, do we think maybe we should not play them
together?
I mean,
there has to be somebody on that staff says, you know, this, I don't think this works.
Right. Or somebody that's on Twitter going, huh, there's some people here who have a fine idea.
Well, I don't think they care what we think, but I would hope that, like I said, I don't claim to be a basketball expert to the level of guys who have been coaching for 20 years, but I think a lot of us see that, like a lot of people who watch a lot of basketball, you know, like all the people I follow on Twitter who follow Marquette basketball, and even some of the analysts on TV have talked about how those guys are better apart, and the fact that the coach and, you know, the coaching staff continues to insist that this team's best chance forward is with those two guys together is a little frustrating. And I see more losses in the future if we're going to continue to try that way.
Yeah, I don't understand how we can – it has to change, right? Like, I would make this prediction right now. We haven't gotten to the prediction portion of the last two games. But if Rousey and Howard play more than 15 minutes together in either of the two games, those will be losses. I feel very confident.
Yeah, I would agree with that, because Georgetown's playing better. Georgetown defensively is not terrible. Like, let's see, what is Georgetown's defensive ranking as we enter the game coming up on Monday? Well, maybe it's a little worse than I thought. They're 98, but that's still better than us.
Right. Well, and they've got some length, right? I mean, that's kind of the Achilles heel, and the exact reason why you split those two up, because you can get away with one sub-6-foot player. You can't get away with – because, quite frankly, and people will say about this DePaul game, oh, they should have played more 2-3 zone. Yeah, maybe, but you can't play 2-3 zone with your 2 6-foot nothing guards up at the top. Those passes into the paint are easy to make with that kind of size, right, at the top of the zone. So it was not a defensive strategy issue. It was a player issue.
Yeah, I think that's really about all we really need to say about the DePaul game. It was very poorly managed. The offense wasn't there, and because of the personnel issues, when the offense wasn't there, the lack of rebounding and the typically bad defense led to a loss. That's really all there is to say about it.
That's the depressing part, right? It's easily diagnosed, which means it should have been easily avoidable, right?
You would think, you know, you can't, if you have any hopes of being a tournament team, you cannot go to DePaul and lose that freaking game.
Do we take any solace in that we've guaranteed an NIT bid at this point?
Not really. The NIT, I mean, that does nothing for me, man.
No, I know it doesn't.
That's a step backward for me. For a team that was in the tournament last year. And I guess that leads me to the next point. I have been on, you know which side I've been on this for a couple weeks now, but we'll bring it up again. Does Marquette still have a chance of making the tournament? I have been debating this with some folks on Twitter. Some people still say 9-9 is going to be enough. And from my perspective, for a team that had fringe bubble hopes to begin with, to go on the road and lose to a team outside the KenPom 100, I guess DePaul is now 99 on KenPom, but point remains, that is a catastrophic loss in my mind, and I think there's no way I can look at that DePaul loss and say things are fine. Things are not fine. Things are very bad right now, and I don't think winning the next two games is going to make up for it. I still think they're going to be out at 9-9. What do you say, Phil?
Here's where I stand. I see if again, this is all predicated on beating Georgetown and Creighton, which are by no means guarantees at all, right? But
yeah, I know can they and will they are two different discussions,
right.
But go on.
But right. So let's assume they will, right? At 9-9, I see the path with the numbers that gets them, like on paper, if you will, they would have justification to put Marquette into the end of the tournament. They would only have one quadrant three loss, which would be this. Thank God this was a loss on the road. Otherwise, this would have been a quadrant four loss. They only have one quadrant three loss. They'll have a handful of quadrant one, undefeated in quadrant four, decent in quadrant two. So, I mean, by the way the committee is ranking these things, they'll check the majority of the boxes that gets them in. They'll have a very high strength of schedule. Their RPI would be historical wheelhouse for getting an at-large bid, admittedly a small one or a high seed versus a low seed. We got to come up with a convention on which way we're declaring. Is a double-digit seed high or low? But anyway, I mean, they're going to – I see the case for it. I see the path. I just think that on paper is not going to be enough, right? I think the committee will, no matter how much they talk about the numbers, the committee will apply a little bit of an eye test and just go, I don't know that Marquette beat enough teams of consequence.
If they're at 9-9, what has to happen in New York to get in?
I think at a minimum, they have to win their first game, because if they're 9-9, I haven't crunched the numbers since the loss, but I think they're guaranteed that their highest seed they could be is a 6 seed. So that probably means the best they can, or that they are going to play on Wednesday. So they can't lose that first round. For me to say they're guaranteed in, they have to win Wednesday and Thursday. That's my position.
See, and that's what I've been saying a lot. The magic number is 11.
Yeah,
you got to get
some
wins
right
in New York. Like, to me, if you go 9-9 and you lose that first game, whether it's to one of the bottom three or you luck out and get the 6 seed and lose to the 3 seed, I still think you're out. Like, I just don't think it's enough. I think you need 9-9 and then some. I think you need something on top of 9-9 for me to feel. To feel good. I mean, if I'm wrong about this, I'll eat crow and I'll be celebrating on Selection Sunday with you guys. I just don't think 9-9 is enough. I think that's very mediocre. I don't think there's enough there. I would also say this: if they're at 8-10, like if they beat Georgetown and lose to Creighton, like they're way out, right?
Yeah. Oh, 100%. Like, there is not a chance on this planet that they get in at 8-10.
And so a win over Creighton moves the meter that much. Like, that's the difference? Like, 8-10, they are way out, but 9-9, you're feeling good?
I would not say I'm feeling good. Let me put it this way. I would put 9-9, I don't feel good, but because I definitely see a case where they don't end up in, but I would say it's like 60-40 we're in at 9-9.
Okay, obviously I'm going a little lower than that, but like if they're 9-9, I'm watching Selection Sunday hoping we're that last team that everyone's saying, wow, I can't believe they got in.
Right.
You know, wow, that was a surprise. I didn't expect, well, you can be that mistake. You could be the team that everyone is surprised gets into the tournament. Like I said, I think if you're at 9-9, you've still got work to do in Madison Square. You've got to get a quality win, not just beating one of those bottom three teams. You got to beat somebody in that next round. You got to beat a Butler or a Creighton or Xavier or somebody in the next round and make sure, you know, obviously beating Villanova would be incredible. And beating Xavier would be incredible too, because they're both in the mix for one seeds. Although as we're recording this, Villanova is losing to Creighton, but it's still early in that one. We'll see how that ends up.
Well, you know, what's interesting is if you could, you know, go back and like switch wins and losses, right? So let's say Marquette beat DePaul and then beat Georgetown and then lost to Creighton and ended up 9-9. I guess for you, would you feel any more or less confident about the 9-9 getting us in?
I still think, like, I guess I'd feel a little better just because you wouldn't have that really stinker, real stinker
right
of a loss to DePaul on there.
That's why you don't feel comfortable with it, because basically what what we're the DePaul loss, what that causes is now we no longer have the narrative of, yeah, we didn't beat the really good teams, but we didn't lose to any bad teams. We played at, you know, we played at a top 50 team level in the country, right? Which gets probably justifies you to be one of the 68 teams in the tournament. But now with the DePaul loss, that narrative is gone, right? I mean, we can't say that we didn't lose to teams that we were better than. I mean, because if they play 9 times out of 10, Marquette, or, you know, 9 times out of 10, Marquette beats DePaul.
Yeah,
Marquette's a better team.
Not Saturday.
No, not at all. I get. This is where I struggle because I get your position. Like, I don't think they passed the eye test. But by the numbers, running the statistics and what the committee says they care about, 9-9 gets them a bubble spot. I mean, I think it's probably one of the – I think they would probably be one of the last four in. So they'd be, you know, they'd be in Dayton. But I think 9-9.
I'd take Dayton for sure. And one thing I will say, the strength of schedule, which is apparently, you know, that's a metric they really care about. That is there for Marquette, and especially if they can get to play one of the elite teams in the Big East in the Big East tournament. And if, like, say you add a third game against Villanova or Xavier, and even if you lose that one, you know that'll be a nice little boost at the very end. That'll kind of make up for having to play one of the bottom three teams again.
Right.
But right now Marquette's in the mix to be one of the bottom three teams themselves, and they could lock it down if they lose to Georgetown on Monday. So that could still happen. So
yeah,
I guess the thing I'm caught in between is the can they and will they. Is the team can be so inconsistent at times, cuz you know sometimes you're going to have a game where all the shots are falling and the offense it just seems unstoppable, but then you're going to have games like Saturday when none of the shots are falling, and then your weaknesses are truly exposed when you're not rebounding and you're not defending and teams are just picking you apart. So the consistency for this team is not there for me to have any hope that they're really going to catch fire in their next three games and really show something to the committee and make a late push to get in. So I guess it's still, like I said, the eye test for me, you know, that old expression, I can't really describe what a tournament team is, but I know one when I see one, and I just don't see one in Marquette. I just don't look at this team and say, "Yeah, that's a tournament team. That's a team that should be in the bracket."
Yeah. Well, the frustrating thing is this is a team. I agree with what you're saying. I just you're not seeing a team that fits in the bracket. But I will say this: whether they deserve to be there or not, this is exactly the type of team that would be very exciting for the tournament, right? I mean, the team is so inconsistent; they could catch fire two games in a weekend and be in the Sweet 16, quote unquote, relatively easily. They could also get blown out in the play-in game in Dayton. I mean, it could go either way.
And another thing that kind of concerns me, like over the next week or two, I think a lot of the teams Marquette's battling with for bubble spots, a lot of them, while they do have tougher schedules, they have more chances to get nice wins. Like any team in the Big 12, they've all got chances to get really nice wins over the next few weeks. And then I guess there are a couple Big 10 bubble teams that can maybe get a nice win or two before things wrap up. Before the Big Ten tournament starts the first week with all the JV leagues, so good for you, Big Ten.
Yeah, way to be a mid-major, Big Ten.
Way to go. Way to go, Big Ten. But yeah, I guess the one thing I will say, though, is there is hope for Marquette to get in the tournament if there are, like, you know, 10, 15 teams that get postseason bans out of nowhere.
Whew, boy. Well, real quick before we move to that, here. So let's say Marquette goes 9-9. And Anonymous Eagle had an article about this, but let's say they go 9-9, and they would be either a team playing in Dayton or they're an NIT berth. Which one do you take?
Are they winning that game in Dayton or are they losing it?
Let's say for the purposes of this, they're losing it.
I'd rather go to the NIT and win a few games.
I agree. What this team needs is practice.
I guess you can technically, I don't know, I mean, I go back and forth on that, because going to Dayton, you can still technically say you're in the tournament, and you eliminate that phrase, Marquette has not made a tournament since,
right.
Or Marquette, you know, you can say Marquette has made back-to-back tournaments. So I guess maybe in some respects I would rather go to Dayton and lose, but going to Dayton and losing, you just don't feel like you're in the tournament. Like, you just, like, your season's over before anything else, before anybody really starts to care.
Right. Well, who is watching on True TV at like 9:30 at night on a Wednesday, right?
Yeah. But I guess I'll take back my answer. I guess just for the sake of that phrase, Marquette has not made a tournament since, you know, or Marquette is only made one tournament in the last 4 years, 5 years, whatever. I guess from that perspective, I'd rather just go to Dayton and lose just to get a tournament streak going, even though it's only two in a row. But
yeah, see, I'd rather go to the NIT for two reasons. One, gets in theory, Marquette should be one of the stronger teams in the NIT. I mean, heck, they could be like a one or a two seed in the NIT if they go 9-9, and that would get them some kind of postseason reps, like kind of those reps around like win or go home, which I think is invaluable for a team that absolutely has to make an NCAA tournament run next year to, I guess I'll put it bluntly, to save the coach's job. They need to get into the tournament and probably win a game or two. But yeah, so I would vote for the NIT. Plus, I mean, I don't know. I'd like to see more basketball out of Marquette, but who knows? I totally get where some fans might be like, you know what? I'm done with this year's team. We can move on. We've seen enough.
I'd like to see more meaningful basketball.
Correct.
From this year's team. So
yeah.
I guess that's why I lean towards Dayton. And plus, hey, if you know, you go to Dayton and win, you can say, hey, we won a tournament game.
Yeah.
Technically.
Yeah, that's true. That's a fair point.
Yes. Yeah, so you can eliminate that phrase. Marquette hasn't won a tournament game since 2013. Well, you can say, well, we did win one. We won in Dayton in 2018. So
hang the banner.
All right. So before we wrap up this podcast, I felt like we should, just because it is the huge cloud hanging over college basketball, just talk about this FBI stuff. Maybe more from a perspective of Marquette fans. I know, looking at it from a national perspective, many of you guys have probably heard analysts all over the country break it down from a national perspective. You know, I see this stuff, Phil, and anytime you see names come out, I think we're all, as much as we love and defend our school to the death, we all want to like read the article first and say, all right, is Marquette in there?
Yeah.
Is there anything from Marquette in there?
I will have an opinion on this story, but first I have to see if anyone from Marquette shows
yes.
up.
Yes. Yeah. Before I give my takes, let's make sure Marquette's not. And you know, Marquette wasn't implicated in the Yahoo article that came out this week. But I guess what is your take on it, Phil? From like when these articles come out and this huge cloud hanging over college basketball as the tournament approaches.
Well, the thing I hate about it is and I get why, you know, and I'm not going to impugn your entire career choice, but I get why journalists break stuff, you know, and it's important for this to come out. But I would much rather this stuff come out kind of like all at once. And, you know, this FBI investigation, I'm convinced, and we saw it kind of announced, we're recording this on Saturday, announced that Sean Miller was on a wiretap for, you know, basically talking about paying a player $100K, right? So it's kind of these dribs and drabs, and I am sure that is not the last of the evidence. I really wish it would come out all at once, you know, like, let's just sit on this until it's all available. But hey, journalists need to make money. I get it. They got mouths to feed. But I guess my take on this is, at the end of the day, like, all of this stuff should be punished, right? Like, it's against the rules. People should become ineligible. Coaches should be you know, Sean Miller, if he's on wiretap talking about a $100K bribe, he should never coach again. Having said that, I think this whole thing just exposes what a rank joke the NCAA amateurism rules are. I mean, what are the punishments going to be? Remember, Juan Anderson got a was it a 2-game suspension because a friend's dad gave them tickets to go to a Brewers game? And are any of these players that were paid, you know, were quote unquote loaned money going to see any suspensions? I'd be skeptical at this point.
Yeah, well, first of all, calling me a journalist is the loosest definition of the term, so thank you for that. But I'm kind of with you. I'm definitely with you on, like, and as many others I think are on the same page. Should the players be getting more money? Yeah, they probably should. Almost certainly should. But the rules are in place now, and people have broken them, and programs that have been run clean that don't give players hundreds of thousands of dollars or funnel them through AAU teams or through sneaker companies, you know, they've been punished for following the rules while others have broken them. Yeah, and I am totally open to the idea of opening up amateurism, going to what more the Olympics are all about, you know, like their model where you can take endorsements, and I think players should be able to, you know, get money off of their likenesses. If the Marquette Spirit Shop wants to sell number zero jerseys, then Marcus Howard should get a share of that. Things like that. If a local car
dealership wants to pay, you know, Theo John exactly. to endorse their cars or whatever.
Yeah, if Nike wants to give Trae Young $1 million when he's 18 years old, let Nike do it. I'm all for that, and let players get market value for whatever their, you know, whatever their face, whatever their likeness and names are worth. You know, like, you know, paying the players from the university, I know maybe there's a, that opens up a can of worms that, you know, maybe would be worth it, but I don't know how you justify, like, if you get into a Title IX issue and you have to pay the non-revenue sports as much as you pay the revenue sports. That may be complicated, but who knows? It's certainly worth exploring. Maybe if the schools can pay certain players certain amounts, and if you have to pay them all the same. But I think the simplest solution certainly is to just open it up for, you know, third parties, outside revenue, sneaker companies, shoe companies, agents. They all do it under the table anyway. Just make it all above the table and make it all legal.
Yeah, exactly.
But as it is now, it is against the rules. It's a shame that it's turning into a federal crime for some of these guys, that some of them could go to jail time because those are the rules that have been in place. But, you know, and hopefully you said more is expected to come out. And I know we all have our fingers crossed that Marquette's is never going to come up in any of this, and hopefully it won't. And if, you know, if programs around the country facing sanctions and postseason bans, well, that would be great for Marquette if they're not one of them.
Right.
And they could try to thrive while other teams are licking their wounds. But, you know, I'm kind of the opinion, I'm not going to be like Mr. Naive and say my favorite team has never done anything wrong because I love them and they're my favorite and they would never do something like that. But I also have really no grounds for saying that Marquette has definitely done this wrong or definitely done that wrong. Like, I would say, in other words, there's nothing that could come out, like, if Marquette were accused of doing this or that, they would say, oh, I'm stunned. I can't believe that happened.
Right.
But as it is now, I'm kind of cautiously optimistic that at least the current administration, the current coaching staff, for the time period they've been investigating, I would hope they've done things the right way. Would I bet my life on that? No. But, you know, who knows, you know, what names are going to come up where. And, you know, we saw names that in that Yahoo story on that guy's ledger who probably wouldn't be the first names you would think of. Like, granted, they're good players and all, but guys that, like, say, Fred Van Vliet was on that list, right? It's not like he's a five-star prospect who was worth millions of dollars. You know, agents meet with these guys and
let's make a distinction between kind of the spreadsheet stuff. Like, if Fred Van Vliet got a lunch paid for or $600, you know, quote unquote loan from a potential future agent, like, one thing I will say, I get it's against the rules and there's the whole institutional control. And I'm not saying this because, quite frankly, I feel like I get a little more legitimacy because it's not like Marquette's been accused of these things, but like, if a player or a player's parents are getting money from agents or whatever, I have trouble, like, holding, you know, the schools themselves accountable, right? Like, if Kentucky's players are getting loans, quote, air quotes, right. Like, and there's no evidence. I mean, we can all speculate. We've speculated that Coach Cal has been dropping bags everywhere, right? I mean, that's just been a thing. But if there's no direct evidence that Kentucky facilitated these players getting these loans from these agents, that's a player eligibility issue. It's not a, like, I don't put the university.
Exactly. That stuff in that Yahoo report isn't bringing down anybody. Like,
right.
Greg Marshall is not in any kind of trouble because Fred Van Vliet's mom may have had lunch with an agent, right?
Right.
We're talking about, like, $40 here, a couple hundred bucks there. We're not talking about, like, the first real bomb, and I'm kind of with you, like, each time something comes out, like breaking news, FBI, I'm like, oh, this is the one. This is the big one, right?
Right.
All the names in it and all the coaches who have paid hundreds. Well, you know, like, the first one, the Yahoo one, was just, like, an expense report, and it could be as simple as a guy who has expensive taste and flies first class and stays in a 4-star hotel and eats steak for dinner and returned. It just turned into a very expensive expense report when he was trying to recruit, you know, the parents of a player. It's not like, there's no hard evidence that, say, you know, some of those guys in that report actually got a check from the agency or that the schools facilitated it. The first real bombshell was that, like you mentioned, the Sean Miller phone call. And I'm sure there will be more things like that to come out. And I guess we're just kind of, one, if, you know, fingers crossed that not too many programs that we really care about our own included, are, you know, have to burn to the ground before this thing gets built back up. But at the same time, like, the whole structure does need to be redesigned as far as amateurism and putting these players in positions where they can make some money and not feel like they're criminals,
right?
And have to sneak around. And it may suck for a couple years when possibly several blue blood programs, you know, top 25 programs are going through sanctions and sitting out postseasons and maybe even having to take banners down like Louisville did. But once that's all over, and if the NCAA is open to letting players have agents and maybe make some money outside the NCAA, I think things will be much better.
Right.
You know, like after you've burned it down and built it back up, you know, like from one perspective, let's say, like you brought the example, like say a local car dealer want, you know, like maybe not every kid can get a Nike or Gatorade sponsorship when he's 18 or 19, but maybe a local car dealer or, you know, your local sandwich shop somewhere wants to give a kid a few hundred bucks, maybe $1,000 here, sell jerseys, have an autograph signing where he pays the kid $1,000 to sit down for an hour or two or sign some autographs. You know, maybe more kids would be in position to stay in school because they're not desperate for money, you know?
Right.
Say a guy like Vander Blue is a perfect example. You know, he left school, he was ready to get paid, he was ready to make some money. Well, maybe if, granted, say, you know, $20,000 a year in endorsements isn't a ton of money, but maybe it's enough to keep his, you know, to help him make ends meet for a year and maybe send some money home if his parents need some or whatever, that maybe he wouldn't rush a decision to the GoPro based solely on money. And I think more kids would be able to make more decisions about going pro because it's not going to be like, man, I got to get money. I just got to make a check somewhere. And I think if you open that up and let kids do that, more kids will make informed decisions about going pro because, yeah, granted, money you get from a jersey sale or money you get from EA Sports using your likeness in the NCAA games probably isn't enough to make you a millionaire. But if it's a little extra money, a few extra thousand here or there, maybe it makes a difference for a few kids who are just really hurting to get a little extra money to send home.
Right. Well, and you did mention, I was going to say, one of the selfish side benefits of this would be that NCAA football and basketball could come back, right? Because you could just...
Exactly. Yeah, let EA Sports give these kids... I don't know how much money you would give every single kid for using their likeness. I don't know what that number would look like, but it'd be something.
Yeah, I mean, think of the... Like, you could even have, like, the walk on's being paid. I mean, who, you know what I mean? Like, I maybe it's $50, but it's not nothing. You know, and I think the one other thing we do have to mention, the only tangentially related Marquette mention in this is our old Philadelphia friend DJ Newbill. He is on one of the accounts as having I think it was gotten lunch with one of the – had his lunch paid for by one of the agents.
As is former Marquette recruit Diamond Stone.
That is true.
He was reportedly a Marquette lean before Buzz left, and then when Buzz left, there was nothing Marquette wasn't even on Stone's radar, and then, you know, Wisconsin fans got all on him when he chose Maryland. But yeah, that was that. Like I said, those are the only two loose Marquette ties to the Yahoo report. So
I don't think I'm breaking any confidences anywhere. I can say for a fact that Diamond Stone had interest with Marquette after Wojo became the coach and was. I guess I would say – I wouldn't say outright rejected, but was like, no, thank you. And so whether that – and I don't think it had anything really to do with the shady business, because I don't know that the schools are really aware – I mean, they're aware that stuff goes on, but I don't think that – you know, it's not like they've got PIs trailing these kids to see who and when they go to lunch and who paid for it, right?
Yeah, and the thing is, who knows, we may never get like – the huge bombshell, right? Like kind of like with the MLB and steroids thing. Like some people were under the impression we'd one day get a big list of every player who did steroids and we'd know all of them. Well, right. We never got that, and we're never going to get that. Same with this NCAA thing. We're never going to get a full list of every player over the last 5-10 years and every dollar those players have been paid and by whom. I don't think we're ever getting that. Now, we may get some bombshells like this Arizona DeAndre Ayton thing. Like,
you know that there's going to be headhunting for like – big name programs, right? I mean, that's like, again, I don't want to make this sound like I'm disparaging an entire, because journalists are invaluable, but you know, journalists are just chomping at the bit to bury Coach K at Duke, or or just go after like.
I don't know if they're like so much trying to bury him as much as they are like. Those are your greatest odds to find one, right?
Right.
Like, if you're going to start investigating, you're not going to go to the Ohio Valley Conference and start investigating those programs.
You're going to go for the ones that are going to be meaningful, right? Like, if I find a coach in the Missouri Valley Conference that paid a player $10,000 to come play that nobody's heard of and the team wasn't that successful, nobody's really going to care. But you're going to care about the coaches that people know about. Like, it's just, I mean, quite frankly, it's market forces, right? Papers are going to sell if I dig up dirt on Coach K more than if I dig up dirt on John Gross at Illinois.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And obviously the bigger names sell more papers. So yeah, I think we will, hopefully, you know, like I said, eventually, hopefully it all burns to the ground, and hopefully Marquette comes out relatively unscathed compared to other big-name programs, and as the college basketball hopefully maybe reforms itself and changes its rules on amateurism, that's probably asking a lot, but hopefully that is what happens, and maybe college basketball will be much better in the long term, and hopefully Marquette will be in position to take advantage of it.
Do you think it changes? Do you think this is the scandal that gets the NCAA to change its ways?
Not unless Mark Emmert gets fired.
That guy's the worst.
I think you got to clean out the top of the NCAA first. Like, I don't know who would be a better president. There are probably a lot of people. I'd give it a shot if no one else wants to do it. But
Jay Billis, like, can we get Jay Billis to run the NCAA?
Jay Billis, he would crush it. But I mean, he would do a great job, but yeah, there are definitely some people out there who are more open-minded, who would have better ideas, like somebody who is as smart and as forward-thinking as a guy like Adam Silver with the NBA. I'm not saying he would leave, but I'm seeing a guy like him,
right?
Somebody of that mindset, who are a little more open-minded and respect the players as much as they do the coaches. And like I said, I don't know how all the financials would work out if schools ended up paying players. I don't know where, you know, like, what are you taking away from? Because obviously that money goes somewhere, but who knows? Maybe it goes into the pockets of the presidents, and I just don't know it. But there's got to be a way to give the players more than they're getting, and hopefully the NCAA is open to that going forward. But yeah, I think that's the first, like, if all that happens here is a few programs get sanctions and we don't change the amateurism rules, then, you know, we'll have more investigations in the future and more players will get, and more, you know, coaches will get arrested and more, you know, there'll be more investigations and there will be more things under the table and banners taken down. And I think that's garbage. And the NCAA's got to, like, just say, maybe it's time to rethink this whole amateurism thing. So,
yeah, I think the real problem is I think what's going to happen, and this is just me being pessimistic and understanding how stupid organizations like this are. I think they're just going to double down and say, oh, we need to enforce the rules more. They're not going to look at it and say, how do we reform and make the rule, you know, how do we adapt rules to the 21st century and kind of the modern society. I think they're going to go, you know what, because you mentioned it, you know, the leadership of the universities, if the universities themselves aren't pushing for reform at the NCAA, the NCAA is not going to reform itself. And the rules, you know, kind of help the universities right now. I mean, they get all the money and power.
Right.
So I guess the pessimistic side of me says, I don't think this is the scandal that brings down the NCAA. I think this is, unless there is, like you said, some ginormous bombshell that I just, you know, I can't fathom right now. I think somehow there's going to be some token. And as long as Emmert's there, who is, he may not be the worst human being on earth, but damn, he's making a running for it.
Maybe the worst leader of a sports organization on earth.
Yeah, that's a guarantee. I would take six Gary Bettmans before I would take a single Emmert.
Would you take him or Sepp Blatter?
Oh, well, 100% I would take Sepp Blatter. Like, Mark Emmert is just, like, both morally and from, like, a running an organization standpoint is, like, incapable. So, yeah, it's real bad.
Yeah. Sorry we went a little national on you in this podcast. Hopefully you guys didn't get too bored with it, but we tried to keep it as a Marquette perspective. Hey, I will say this. For those of you hoping Marquette adds players, if some of these teams lose players in the spring, right, there's always that last hope, even though a lot of star point guards and have been scooped up, a lot of them may become available if certain programs come under come under sanctions, and these guys maybe have outs in their letters of intent that would let them out if coaches are fired.
Let me ask you, if there's a hot point guard, I'm not gonna put your secondary team on blast here. We'll say it's a Gwenton Crimes. Let's pretend there's a point guard named that. You know, and a program becomes suspended, but said guard is under, I won't say under suspension, but is one of the players that was on a spreadsheet somewhere. Do you take him at Marquette?
If he's on a spreadsheet, no. But if the guy's just cut loose, like, I would, you know, Villanova's taking a gamble with this Javon Quinterly kid, who was in the initial FBI report when he was an Arizona commit, right?
Right.
He was rumored, and then, you know, Villanova did its research, and they feel confident that he's going to be cleared. I don't know if he had to give money back or whatever, but they are confident. And, yeah, if there are blue-chip guards out there, and if they are suddenly let free because their coach gets fired or their program is under sanctions, if you think there's a chance he could play and help your team, hell yeah. Bring him in.
As long as they're not on a list somewhere.
Right, yeah. You do your research, and that's the coach's jobs, and that's the university's jobs. You do your research. You do your own investigation. You talk to the kids. You talk to the parents. You talk to whoever you have to talk to. Say, look, if we bring this kid in, can he play? Is he going to be eligible to play, or are we wasting a scholarship? If you think there's a chance, you do, because like I said, that's what Villanova is doing with that Javon Quinterly kid. They feel very confident that he is going to be cleared of wrongdoing and be eligible to play next year and take over for Jalen Brunson. That's what they're banking on. And there are certainly guards out there who are committed to Kansas, Arizona, some other places, who may suddenly be eligible or may suddenly be available and looking for teams. So I would say keep an eye on those over the next 6 weeks.
Yeah.
That's all I'll say there.
We could fill a roster spot.
Yep. Marquette has a scholarship available for next year. At least one. We'll see what happens over the next few weeks. That's a whole other podcast. As always, thank you guys for listening. Again, we hope the national conversation didn't get too boring for you, but we did want to maybe get just at least touch on the thing that's hanging over college basketball. One other Marquette note that, again, as we're recording this Saturday afternoon, we don't know any more details. It was a big bummer to see Jimmy Butler go down with a knee injury. Was that Friday night?
Yep, Friday night.
Hopefully he's all right and can play again this season, but if he's out for the season, that is just a real bummer because he is Marquette's best NBA player currently, and he's had such a good career so far, and hopefully it's just a minor setback and he'll be fine. But dang it, it's been a rough week to be a Marquette basketball
fan. It has been not good.
It's been a rough 48 hours. So before we get out of here, Phil. I guess short prediction for the final week of the regular season, believe it or not.
Yeah, it is Marquette the final season or final week, and it's the final Saturday will be the final game Marquette plays at the Bradley Center unless there are NIT games.
Gosh, I guess that's something we probably could have gotten to the podcast. We've almost gone an hour anyway. Quickly, best memories for you from the Bradley Center.
Best memory? It's got to be when they won the Conference USA in 2003 when we stormed the court. And Marquette famous picture of Dwayne Wade and the American flag in which you can clearly see us and several of our friends. That's got to be my number one, I think.
All right, so yeah, was that photo from 2003 when they won the conference championship or 2002 when they upset number two Cincinnati?
There's two pictures. Right?
There are two pictures, but yeah, I know because I was there as a student for both of those games, and like those are obviously my best memories. I would think most other people would say best Bradley Center memories would probably include certainly beating Villanova last year.
Yep, I was there for that. That was great.
I think most people would have that as a top three, if not number one, and the first Big East game when Steve Novak went off for 41 points.
Yeah, 41 against UConn. I also think another one, it's kind of subtle, but Steve Novak's fadeaway two to beat Notre Dame, I think that was kind of a great, fun little memory, like a snowstorm outside and stuff like that. But yeah, I think probably the top three have got to be beating Villanova when they're number one and probably winning the conference championship in 2003. And then I guess that Cincinnati game probably.
Yeah, cause I remember that because that was like Marquette's big coming out party under Tom Crean.
Yep.
Right? Like that was like the first like huge win for Crean and Wade and that whole group, and they would go to the Final Four the next year. But that was kind of a big moment for me when wow, our team's actually pretty good. Like we actually might be a really good team. I think Cincinnati came in on like something like a 20-game winning streak.
Yeah, but wasn't that just that game was just after Kenyon Martin broke his leg?
Oh no, Kenyon Martin. That was 1999.
Oh yeah, you're right. I'm getting them way mixed.
That was. I mean, that Cincinnati team was completely healthy, and like Steve Logan was their best player.
Oh yeah, that's right. That was the Logan.
Donald Little was their big guy, I think. And there was nothing. Like Kenyon Martin broke his leg in the Conference USA tournament his senior year in 99-2000, and Marquette never played Cincinnati without Kenyon Martin, and thank good, and because every time they did play Kenyon Martin, it went very, very poorly.
Those were not
Marquette's best years, but I would put those in like just I'm biased to this two Cincinnati wins just because I was there in person. Obviously, I don't go to as many Marquette games in person as you do, or all of you guys who live in Milwaukee, but. I would say in some order, yeah, I would say the first win over Cincinnati in 2002 when Marquette stormed the floor. They beat, I think Cincinnati was number two in the country at the time.
Yep.
The win over number one ranked Villanova I think is going to be number one for a lot of people. And maybe some recency bias there, but I don't think that takes away from what a huge game that was and what a memorable moment that was for the program. And yeah, I think the first Big East game, Novak's 41 points is also... I'd put those three kind of in some order. My favorite Bradley Center memory, and you know, it'd be nice if you can close it out with a win. I would say no. I'm gonna say Georgetown. I'm gonna say they beat Georgetown on Monday, but I'm gonna say the pick and roll of Creighton just tears them apart on Saturday. And I'll say they go 1-1 this week,
man,
finish 8-10.
As much as I want to say 2-0, but I think they go 1-1. I don't know which one they lose, but they're going to go 1-1. And the only nice thing, I suppose, is the torture of whether or not we would be in or not, because we would definitely be out and can just start planning our NIT watch parties.
Or just, you know, start lighting candles and hoping for a miracle in the Big East tournament.
Yeah, that ain't
I guess
happening.
That will be the topic for our next podcast about a week from now. So.
Yeah, that could be. But it's not going to be a very optimistic podcast then.
Who knows? Maybe our opinions will totally change. We'll be talking about tournament hopes because I feel like we go back and forth on this. Definitely done, still hope. Definitely done, still hope. I think we're kind of in the middle right now. I'm kind of on definitely done, but let's cling on to hope for one more week and hope they can go 2-0. I'm, for the record, I'm thinking it. They're going 1-1 this week, and Phil, you say the same. So.
Yep.
Here's to hoping we're wrong again, because being wrong can be fun sometimes.
It can.
As always, folks, we appreciate your feedback and listening to the podcast. You can always hit us up on Twitter with your thoughts. I'm Joe McCann 3. Phil is M-O-O-O-F. That's three O's, 23. Hit us up on the team handle at Crack Sidewalks. You can go to cracksidewalks.com, leave your comments under the podcast where we post them. You can also please subscribe, rate us, and review us on iTunes, and there's also a Scrambled Eggs Facebook page as well. Any final thoughts, Phil, before we get out of here?
No, let's just not lose to Georgetown.
Split up the little guys and give them a shot.
Yeah, please, Wojo. I'm begging you.
Until next time, seashells and balloons, everybody.